everyone. My name is Sophie Devonshire, and I'm the Chief Executive of the Marketing Society. And it's day three for me in this new role. So I couldn't be more delighted that one of the first things I get to do in my very first week is to introduce you to this webinar today and to welcome you all to a session on creativity during COVID-19 and to be introducing you to a man who I have always admired. Today is Wednesday, the 1st of July. Can you believe that we've already got through 6 months of this crazy and challenging year? I've really appreciated the notes and the messages I've got from people as I've started this role, telling me what you value about the Marketing Society and what things you want to see more of and what you're enjoying. And I know a number of you have said how much you're enjoying the events we're putting on, ones like this. The focus across the last 3 months have been threefold. First of all, we've wanted to look out for everybody's well-being. Secondly, we want to keep our members inspired and motivated through these challenging times. And most importantly, we really want to stay connected as a global community who can help each other, support each other, and learn together, as we will be doing today. We believe we're stronger when we do things together, when we share ideas, when we support, and when we work together in sessions like this. So today our speaker joins us to share some perspectives and some stories about his career, the highs and lows of almost five decades that he's been in journalism and in the public eye. In fact, he's been in journalism for almost as long as the Marketing Society has been active. An incredible amount of time where he's seen some amazing things happen and change. And he's going to talk today a little bit about actually how he's seen TV and the world change and adapt and think creatively across the last few challenging weeks. But this session isn't just about him sharing his stories. It is about you, everybody who's joined us today. And I'm sure that what he has to say today will give you some ideas and some thoughts and definitely some questions. So at the end of the session, we are going to spend a little bit of time together. And we'd like to encourage you all to join us for an interactive Q&A and to talk to John and ask some questions. We want to feel connected. We want to see your faces if we can. So we will be asking you at the end to turn on your cameras. If you're naked, you can keep the cameras off, don't worry, but do stay on to join us for the conversation at the end of the session. We'd also love you to use the chat function that we have on Zoom here today. It's really fun for everybody involved and more interesting if we can be interactive. So to ask you now to check that you know how that chat function works, and just to see who's awake, and hear some stories, can I ask you all to come and say hello on the chat function in Zoom? Tell us where you're dialing in from. Where are you joining us from today? And maybe you could tell us some news today. Give us a headline. Tell us one thing that's happening in your world or around you. I'd love to hear from you. Look, there's Liesl. Nice to see you, Liesl. Who's out there? Where are we dialing in from today? I know there's lots of people joining from around the world. I can already see some people coming from different places. What's the news? Give us some stories. Southeast London, marvellous. Thank you, Danica. What news from sunny Surrey? And hello from Hong Kong. Hi, Christopher. Any news from Hailing Island, Charlie? Ah, in Dubai today, apparently, it's all bright and sunny and life is looking up. Wow. Steve's working on 250 new TV advertisers. Wow. Michael has discovered the best COVID response yet. The French biscuit maker who's changed their biscuits to say merci beaucoup. Marvellous. Oh, and people watching from cars. Thank you very much. Oh, enjoying a coconut fish dal, eating while you listen. How perfect. Well, welcome everybody. And please keep using this chat function to make comments and to let us know what you're thinking as we go through. There is also the Q&A function that you can all see at the bottom of your screens. If you've got some questions for John as we go through, please add your questions there, and we'll also have a chance for you to ask them in person or live at the end of it all. So back to our speaker today. I was talking to a marketeer the other day who used to be a journalist, and they were talking about how those two professions are actually inextricably linked. That need to be a phenomenal communicator. The importance of finding human insight and sharing what's relevant to your audience. The skill of storytelling, changing the way people feel and act as a result of the news that you bring them and the stories that you share. We're very, very lucky today to be joined by an incredible, groundbreaking, award-winning journalist, John Snow, Channel 4's longest-running presenter, who's been the face of Channel 4 and a household name since 1989. And prior to Channel 4, he was with ITN, he was a Washington correspondent. And across his career, he's traveled the world to share amazing stories and covering the news. From the fall of the Berlin Wall and the release of Nelson Mandela, to Barack Obama's inauguration and the earthquake in Haiti. He's always brought important stories to everybody who's listening. And of course, it would be a crime for me not to mention, but as well as the unforgettable stories and his style in sharing them, he's also, across the years, sported some pretty unforgettable ties as well. And I've already seen that he's got a very special one for us today. A distinctive look, a differentiated look, for somebody who's a really distinguished journalist. We're so pleased that he's with us here today. John's many awards include the Richard Dimbleby's BAFTA Award for Best Factual Contribution to Television and Royal Television Society's Awards for Journalist of the Year and Presenter of the Year in 2009. And he's a BAFTA Fellow as well. He's a thoroughly impressive chap, to say the least. And today, John is going to be interviewed by the fab Claire Peters, who is Deputy Head of Clients at Channel 4. Claire leads the client sales strategy and manages its dedicated client sales teams within its function, the award-winning ad sales division for sales. And she's worked for many years in the media world. And before joining Channel 4, she was Manning Gottlieb OMD's Chief Business Strategist. So she's always worked with clients to help find new and innovative ways to solve business challenges, boost effectiveness, and increase profitability. So Claire, John, a very warm welcome to you both today. And without further ado, over to you.
Thank you, Sophie. What a lovely introduction. Where's my other half today? Can I see John?
For some reason,
he's hiding his tie.
Right, we've got him on video. Unmute yourself, John.
Here we are.
Brilliant.
Sorry about that.
Quite all right. How are you this afternoon?
Well, I must tell you something, Claire, before we even discuss how I am this afternoon, because I must confess that we never had anything to do with marketing. Nobody ever said, oh, listen, you lot must get together. And it seems to me absolutely crazy that we never had anything at all. This is the first time you and I have met. I mean, other than the other day when you set me up as it were and said, this is what we're going to do. But seriously, it seems to me to make absolute sense that marketeers and the people actually on the screen should get together at times. And we can talk about our audience and what we think, you know, our own interaction with them and where it might play if any advertiser is. In these really troubled days, the only way we're ever going to proceed is if all of us pull together. So I'm delighted to meet you, and you're smiling, so you must be delighted to see me.
I am. You're already getting compliments on your tie, I can see. Can you just tell us about the tie, please? Because we've already had a chat about this.
It was a painted silk tie, and there it is. And it's my trademark, I suppose. The funny thing is, I only ever did this lark with ties because I was the dullest thing on the screen. I thought I must get something other than a suit and a white shirt.
Don't believe that.
You know, and ties are it.
Well, look, I know that you're really keen and to talk to people today, not just to me. So I guess we'll kick off with some questions to get the sort of room, as it were, warmed up. And then we'll definitely be introducing people later to come and have a chat with you, because I know that you are very, very keen to share all of your experiences and really let people ask you their own questions. That's going to be really pertinent to their organisations and their jobs. So I guess I wanted to start off today, actually, in on a more personal level and ask you how you are, because obviously what we've all been going through over the last months, and seeing Jon Snow, the presenter on Channel 4 News, obviously you've been going through this personally with us as well. And, you know, following your trip from Iran and being one of the first sort of public figureheads to go into isolation, I just thought I'd like to ask you, how's life in lockdown been for you?
I'm stir crazy. I mean, you know, I mean, it has not been a great experience, I have to say. But it is extraordinary, because it's been possible to be locked down and continue to broadcast, at least. And I mean, I know nothing about technology at all. And the thought of trying to manipulate a camera or trying to sort out the auto cue or anything, really. I couldn't. And the extraordinary thing is that everything's driven from the center. You know, they pop the camera on, nobody comes here, nobody came here to install it even. My wife had a nephew who was very very technically savvy, and he sorted it out. But I mean, I get auto cue, I can see the person I'm interviewing right down the lens of the camera. So I'm reading the auto cue off the camera lens. It's bounced up from an iPad that's lying below. And then they simply switch the iPad to the person I'm interviewing, and it's like talking to you now, which is incredible. And apparently 3 years ago was not possible.
I mean, how was that the first time you did it? That must have been so nerve-wracking, you knowing that that is going out to the nation. I mean, it's bad enough doing it on a forum like this, let alone when you know that the whole nation is watching you.
Well, you know, it was a different sort of experience from that. I kept seeing images of my grandson, who's aged 7 months, rolling around on the floor. I mean, he wasn't there at the time, but he is normally. I mean, he can be. And I mean, it was just the domesticity of the room in which I'm speaking to even now, because I'm sort of halfway between the kitchen and the living room. And I don't know if you can see the camera. So see if you can see it in the corner there. It's sort of the window. And I remember thinking halfway through one of the programs early on, I thought, oh God, yes, I must remember to do that when I get home. And you know, you are home. You know, it becomes very, very confusing. And it's not the best story, to be honest, having to do it this way. But at least we've been able to keep going.
Well, I mean, I was going to ask that, because, you know, a lot of organisations have been going through those same things. You know, how do we keep going? How do we keep a normal day-to-day existence when everything, you know, that we're used to has been thrown up in the air? I mean, the logistics of it must have been incredible. Were there any moments where you just no one knew whether it was actually going to be possible?
At the very beginning, I didn't think it would be possible, but there were better brains than mine that already decided it was possible. So that wasn't too bad. The really bad thing was that the installers of some internet connection decided to dig up the road at the same time we were trying to pre-record interviews with people, etc. So I had to keep dashing out there and slipping them a tenner to shut up for 10 minutes.
Let's talk about, you know, the experiences that you've been going through, actually sort of personally living through this pandemic and then actually presenting on it and reporting on it. I mean, how does it's almost like a news story that's affected the news, which it must be incredibly unique. But how does that compare, or is it in any way comparable to some of the other global stories that you've reported on in your career?
Well, I mean, first of all, the mechanics even of approaching the story are completely different, because I mean, I confess I'm a people person. I'm completely dependent on people. I'm not really good with my own company. So having my own company here in the presence of a television camera isn't the most stimulating experience. But, you know, when you're at work and you're putting together Channel 4 News, there are about 80 people in the room. There are graphic designers, there are editors, there's you know, video editing and all the rest of it. And there are also a lot of other journalists. And so, for example, let's say you're going to interview, I don't know, some... you know, epidemiologist, well, then you will be in the same room as the medical correspondent, who will say, by the way, John, do you know this guy is the guy who got it all wrong last time? So, you know, go at him, or well, you know, this guy's a genius, he'll know all the answers or whatever. You get none of that. And the fact is, out of sight, and, you know, out of contact, nobody bothers to call you up. They're all struggling to do the same thing. They're all struggling to work in abnormal circumstances. And so, you suddenly have to be your own feeder completely of how you're going to question people and the rest of it. I mean, a few people send you emails and say, try asking him this. But generally speaking, anyway, I mean, actually covering the pandemic has been an extraordinary challenge, because basically we're dealing with a subject, first of all, a medical subject that none of us have ever really tackled before. And we're dealing with very, very different opinions by very, very different epidemiologists, by competing politicians, by you know, all sorts of people who are trying to sell you a story. I mean, actually, of course, we all know. I mean, don't tell anybody. And if anybody is in the room, don't you tell anybody either. But the truth is, the government really pulls it up at the first instance. I mean, we did lock down far too late, and we've paid dearly for it. But, you know, trying to divine the truth when you've got people who have different scientific views of what should be done is actually very difficult, and particularly when you're operating on your own.
And you were telling me the other day that just the difference when you're covering something like this versus when, for example, you went to the Twin Towers. Tell us about
the barren wasteland that is this pandemic, which is people locked up. I mean, you know, the lack of life and society and the rest of it is one thing. Then contrast that with the Twin Towers. I got there, you know, the whole of New York was shut down as if to a pandemic for about 11 days. And it was about then that I got in, and I was very, very lucky. I had a friend who was a brilliant photographer and worked for the Parks Department. And the Parks Department ordered him to record the evolving retrieval of Ground Zero. And he said to me, look, John, I can get you and your cameraman onto Ground Zero. And no media had been allowed into Ground Zero itself. And so about 3 weeks after the actual ghastly attack, there we were. And the amazing thing was that the ground was incredibly hot. The place was utter chaos. They were still digging for bodies. There were still firemen trying to put out fires and the rest of it. And there, for television, I mean, the whole thing was there in front of you. It was just, you know, managing to record it all. Wherever you looked, there was a story. You know, there would be a notebook on the floor, or there'd be photographs of loved ones, or whatever it was. There were the chaos of everything that had been thrown out of those buildings and then caught fire or not caught fire. You know, that's just a challenge to capture it all. This is a challenge to say anything at all. Well, then you couldn't keep your mouth shut and you couldn't keep the camera off. Here, I mean, hell, shut it down. You won't be any the wiser.
Do you think that, you know, there must be stories that you've come across, even though we've been all been in lockdown, that, you know, human stories, things that maybe don't make the news, that, you know, that you've come across that have really sort of had a lasting impact on you over the last few months. Are there any that, you know, really kind of spring to mind, or have you really been that sort of isolated from it that you're literally just reporting, you know, the facts and the news as it comes?
I have been very, very isolated from it. And if you contrast that with the last, obviously nothing like on this scale, but the last, but on another scale, very great indeed, Grenfell Tower. I was down there, you know, as soon as it happened. And I'll tell you this, that the next day, I was broadcasting from there, actually from the scene for about 4 days. But on the second day there, I was wandering around and I saw on a concrete wall photographs of people who were missing, and I recognized one of them. It was a child, a 12-year-old child. And about, in fact, exactly 50 days earlier, I had been with the head of Microsoft, yes, him himself, at a great do for kids, writing essays and news reports and things. And we had to judge the best. And they were each in categories. There was sort of 12 to 15, 15 to 18, and 18 to 21. And I was in the 12 to 15. And this face that I'd seen on the wall belonged to Firdaus. And Firdaus had won. She had written the most brilliant, brilliant take on a particular story, and she'd won the prize, and she'd been incinerated in the Grenfell Tower. So that's something tangible from a very tangible disaster. Here you have an intangible disaster, which is inflicting extraordinary experiences on us all, because many of us have never spent so much time on our own, and many of us have never stayed in one place for so long. It's unlike anything I've ever worked on before.
I've just had a question come through actually that relates to what you're talking about, and that is a lot of people listening today, you know, cover international businesses, and obviously you cover international stories. How do you go about getting local kind of knowledge, if you like, the feelings, ideas, the behaviours of people locally when you're covering something that's international?
You've got to get down and dirty. I mean, just get right in there. I mean, you know, it depends what the circumstance is, but if there are clubs and bars, or there are, you know, there are all sorts of kind of touchstones that you're going to spend some time, even a railway station, whatever, where you can encounter people and the rest of it. And obviously, you're also picking the brains of any other journalist you can find as to whether they have any contacts in that particular area or in the industry that's affected or whatever it is. You're looking for ways in, either making them yourself in person or tapping them on your mobile, having got the number of a friend or whatever it is. I mean, you're looking for ways in all the time. But it's those first-hand contacts that really make all the difference. And in a way, it's a bit the way you work. I mean, you're looking for... Yes. You're looking for ways in. You're looking for a way to capture people. I do it differently and whatever, but our aim is the same, to tell a story.
I think interesting though is, you know, from personal experience, I'm not speaking for everyone else, but I don't think we do enough of that, actually. You know, I think often we probably create focus groups or look at trend reports or look at reports and you know, general behaviours around audiences. I think what you're talking about is actually it's the nuances, it's the personal contact, it's those personal conversations that really give you, you know, an edge, if you like, and give you something to hang your sort of hat off. So I think that's...
Well,
that's
I'll say something dangerous, because I think both me and you need people, and we like people. We like people because they buy our products or they watch our news. But connecting with them is the absolute key. And I think, you know, just as you sell products and we tell the news, the viewer can tell, are you really interested in this? Have you really got on top of all of this? Do you really understand what you're doing? I mean, you're better at it than we are because you package it better and you've got lots of time to do it. If we're doing it instantly in the day and the rest of it. But I think the viewer does engage very much with people on the screen, and they can tell very quickly whether they are really in it or whether they're just acting a part.
Yeah, it'd be good to talk a little bit about the role of the news actually over the last few months. And you know, I know from personal experience, certainly that first 4 weeks, it was a ritual in our house. Everyone used to sit, you know, wait for the news, sit in front of it, find out what was going on. I don't think we've ever, not in my lifetime, have ever seen anything so blanket coverage and so sustained. Do you think that this will change people's relationship with the news? And we'll go on to talk about young people in a minute, but do you think there's been potentially a shift in society overall, and that has sort of really come to bear over the last few months, where people are looking for that trust, the facts, transparency? Do you think that relationship that has changed recently will be sustained after we come out of COVID?
I think it's definitely changed. Because, we on Channel 4 News have experienced a real uptick, a really big uptick in viewing. And I think part of that is about coming together to learn the same information at the same time. There's sort of old fashioned sense of news. I mean, until this period of the pandemic, we've been building vast audiences online. Ludicrous followings on Twitter, etc. I mean, I have 1.4 million followers. Well, that is, it beggars belief, doesn't it? It's ridiculous. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, in the old days, it was axiomatic that we would watch the television news, and there was a sense the country was watching at the same time. And then that's begun to be undermined by the access to online info. And, I mean, you know, we very often will have a 10 million viewing figure on YouTube, which is much greater even than the people who are paying us, which is Channel 4. I don't know. I mean, I don't think it'll be sustained. I mean, in the end, it's much easier to watch on your mobile wherever you are or, you know, whenever you want to watch it. Whether we've created any kind of a habit that will have an overhang afterwards. Well, will there ever be an afterwards? That's a big question. Anyway.
Let's keep it positive.
Maybe there will be an overhang, and it'll be up to us to try to sustain it. Because we all know television is still a bloody good medium.
So yeah. And
the TVs have got so good too. I'm afraid to say that one of the things that I did during lockdown was to buy a new TV. And boy, I didn't know TV was so good. In the sense of...
The smart ones.
Technically, so brilliant, beautiful. I'd have an awful old thing which has been knocking around in the corner for about 6, 8, 10 years.
Exactly. And I mean you've touched upon social channels and the importance of those in terms of getting the news out. Do you, the young audiences that you have following you, and Channel 4 in particular, why do you think young people are so drawn to Channel 4 news in particular? And again, do you think that's something that we're seeing in society where they are going to more sort of those trusted channels for their news versus maybe, happy to sort of get it from any source, which has been the case over the past few years?
I mean, it's difficult to say, really. Maybe we're slightly less po-faced. Whoops. Or is it that actually in the end, if you decide you're actually going to try to consume some news, it might be worth doing it at reasonable length instead of, you know, gobbets, very short. You know, it's incredible. Even News at 10, which I loved working for, but I mean, the longest report you could ever have would be 2 minutes. You know, whereas we can put one out for 8 minutes as we did the other day, or even 10 or 12. So I think it's possible that young people are demanding more depth, more information, and that is working in our favour. Also, I do think it's important to be real. And you can afford to be real in an hour. In fact, you can't not be real for an hour. It's a jolly long time not to be real, to be acting up to something else. You know, somebody frankly important or something. We're not important, but we are interested. And
we just had a question actually come through from Fran asking, you know, getting the balance right between the volume of reporting as we need greater access to information and faster information, and how you balance that with, you know, the depth of reporting. So it'd be interesting to get your take on how you create that balance and whether that's changed over time.
I think it has changed over time. And I think, you know, there are times when you just decide to devote a very great deal of energy and resource and time to one particular story. I mean, let's take Hong Kong, for example, which is going on right now. We've got somebody following us right now from Hong Kong. I'd much rather hear from them than he would want to hear from me, I think, really. But still, it is interesting that, you know, that there is an appetite to watch 10 minutes of news from Hong Kong. You know, it's a seismic moment. Great Britain PLC is back in the box and China's nicked the lot.
Yeah. Also, just in terms of, I know we talked about this the other day, and I see questions come up from Caroline around this as well. So what you think about COVID-19 in terms of what advantages it's brought to the nation, what unity it's brought, but then equally the inequality that has maybe arisen and or certainly come to the fore. I mean, even the news on Leicester yesterday. So it'd be interesting to get your view on that as well.
I think very early on we began to realise that the lockdown was going to be a very different experience for different socioeconomic groups. And I think, I mean, funnily enough, I found myself thinking back to Grenfell. I mean, I'd spent no time wandering up and down local authority tower blocks until Grenfell. And the height, the isolation, and the sense, you know, that during lockdown, these thousands, tens of thousands of local authority tower blocks were containing people who had no garden, no outside space, great difficulty in leaving the building even really, and fear of leaving, quite understandably, fear of leaving the building. And one, you daren't even really imagine the tensions and the frustration and boredom that must have set in. I mean, you know, most of us engaged in this coming together as we are as over marketing, most of the people will have had some access to outside space, and probably living more on ground level than up in the sky. Yeah.
And there's a couple of questions that have come through as well. People asking about how do you remain impartial when you've obviously got views of your own, and how that affects you when you're covering a story.
There's no question that you have to admit that it will, you know, you've got to fight your prejudices. It will affect the way you approach the story, and you've got to correct yourself. I mean, you've got to be guided by the truth if you can possibly dig it up. I mean, it's a touchy question, you know, because I do have strong views. I make no bones about it. not necessarily party political, but more, I don't know, sociological. And I mean, it's a damned good question. How do I deal with it? Do I deal with it? I mean, maybe I sometimes think maybe they watch because they want to catch me out, or they want to, there he goes, that bastard. You know, I don't know. It's a very, very good question. And I hope I succeed in containing whatever my prejudices are. But then in the end, all of us have views. And that's what makes us tick. And in fact, the viewlessness of COVID, which is so all-threatening that you haven't got time to sort of dissect it and find out whether you agree with it or disagree with it. I mean, it's a very odd time.
I wanted I'm going to open up to the floor shortly, actually, but I wanted to ask a question that, because I know there's lots of people wanting to ask you questions as well. I've tried to cover a few of them as we've been chatting. But I wanted to actually ask you about international journalism. Like we take it for granted in the UK, what we hear, what we see, the presenters we have on our screens. And I know that you recently interviewed some of the winners of the One World Media. And I just, a lot of time we talk about brave leadership and being brave and how we break boundaries. I just want you to talk a little bit about your experiences and what you've learned and what we can take forward from learning from people that are, you know, breaking ground in ways that probably not, a lot of us can would find quite unimaginable.
Well, I mean, the winner of the One World Award was Maria, living in the Philippines, who has fought an extraordinarily brave campaign against what is a very nasty regime. She's now been taken to court. She actually won her award the very day that she was found guilty of whatever crime they decided to inflict upon her. She's got an appeal, but nobody really believes the appeal will work, and she faces 6 years in jail for brilliant reporting over a very long period of time. I just before the lockdown, as you mentioned, I was in Iran, and that's an amazing, interesting story, because you only need to say the word Iran and people say, ooh, you haven't been there, have you? And you think, God, I was so blessed. I mean, I've been to one of the most beautiful countries I've ever been to, some of the most beautiful cities in the world, a place where it's impossible to fail to understand that this is a 6,500-year-old civilization. Now, of course, it's got a hopeless regime, horrible. I mean, you know, it's not working well for the people, And but then on the other hand, there've also been external forces playing with them all the time, never giving them a chance and the rest of it. And there, of course, I was there in time for the outbreak of the coronavirus, which hit Iran very badly. And the resilience of the people was just incredible, absolutely wonderful. In Isfahan, there's an amazing bridge with 35 arches. And it's a great promenading place. Everybody walks along it. And the number of people who came up to me and talked to me were wearing masks. And I mean, heavens, I hadn't come across anybody wearing a mask until that moment, not realizing, there we were. Anyway,
it's going to happen, yeah.
I'm prattling on boring you.
I think actually I'm hoping that everyone's poised to join us now. Sophie, Linda, I think, hi.
Hello. Thank you, Claire. Thank you, John. Wow, so interesting. I mean, yes, as we mentioned earlier, we would love everybody to join us now. So the team are going to be promoting everybody to come into the room, into the virtual room. So if you are in your pyjamas, or if your ties aren't as smart as John's, we'd still love to see you if you'd like to show your faces. So you just press the button that says accept, and you'll come and join us, and we can ask some more questions and actually see people, because John, you said you like people.
I like people a lot. I like Adrian Foster looks good.
We've got a contender. Excellent.
Adrian, do you want to unmute your
yes, microphone? Hi there. Hi. Wonderful to listen in, John. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you. It wasn't very difficult. we recently actually convened about 40,000 people in a virtual conference at the beginning of June called COGEX. And as kind of head of design, I'm very curious about what it's like to be a speaker or an interviewer. And I was just wondering if there's one kind of big problem or challenge that you've got that would be just the single biggest thing that you would love to resolve just by going on air and speaking to people, if there was anything that kind of really stood out.
I think more than any other single thing, and it's one word that we've already mentioned, inequality. I think the thing about the pandemic has been that it's exposed the inequality across our society, and I think across virtually every society in the world. We have somehow to bring people together at more even circumstances. I mean, I'm not a communist or anything, but I, I just think that we can't go on living in this incredibly divided way in such a small space, in which it's so obvious to people that it's there, and we're doing very little about it. People run scared and say, "Oh God, you're talking socialism or communism or anything like that." We're not. We're just trying to talk about evening up, broadening opportunity, and we can all do it. We can all do it. We can all provide chances for people, people who probably would not have a chance otherwise. That's the biggest single thing that drives me, I must say. And I try to bring people into the workplace, you know, and show them what's going on. And I go to schools and colleges, etc., and try to encourage people to be brave and go for it.
Yeah, thank you.
Right. The need for bravery in difficult times. So, Jeremy's putting his hand up. Old school, perfect, exactly what we want. Jeremy, you have a question for John.
Yeah, John, you alluded that you've got 1.5 million followers and you were amazed by that. But there are 22-year-olds and Zoellas of this world, the influencers, that have got 5, 10, 20, 30 million. And yet you're doing such good work and they're talking about drivel. How do you feel about that?
I feel there's room for all of us. I really do. I am very pleased to see that certain other participants in the Facebook world, for example, are being damped down a bit. I think it's wonderful that corporations are moving against outlandish stuff on. I'm no censor or anything like that, but that, you know, there's no question there's some bad stuff going on, not least led by Donald Trump. This fake news stuff is horrible. No, I respect all these people. I mean, if they're having fun, that's fine, or they're promoting themselves, or whatever. They may be talking what you and I may see as dribble, but it may be fun to people who follow them. And there's space for all of us. It's just that we shouldn't do what the Donald does, which is the lie.
Yes, I love your, you've got to be guided by the truth if you can possibly dig it up. That's a thing to remember.
Why not? Yeah.
So who else would like to ask a question of John while we're in this room together? Raise your hands or...
I wouldn't if I were you. I mean...
Fran, what's your question?
Hi, John. So my question is really about... so much of the news is dark and quite rightly so in lots of ways. But I was wondering what your most joyous news story ever was, and what you got most pleasure from telling people and from announcing to the nation.
Well, it's funny you should ask that, because actually one of my most joyous reports was during the lockdown. I live very near the zoo, London Zoo, and a man who I didn't know popped a note through my door and said, "Are you aware that," and this was about 5 or 6 weeks ago, maybe more, "are you aware that there's a real crisis in the zoo because they have 18,000 hungry mouths that have to be fed? It costs $2 million a week to keep the whole of the zoo infrastructure and the research and everything else going. Can you do anything about it?" And so I rang the director's office, and the director said he would see me and that we could come to the zoo with our camera. And so I broke my lockdown without making any fuss about it, not ensuring anybody really bothered, but there we are. We went to the zoo, and it was magic. Because going into a zoo where there are no people is a most extraordinary experience, because the place is full of animals. I know that sounds obvious, but for example, penguins. I mean, I've never been, well, I've been a bit of a penguin man. I mean, I've been to the Antarctic and seen them en masse and the rest of it. But to go to the penguin pool, where clearly some of them were very frustrated not to have seen a human for a very long time, was absolutely amazing. And they waddled up to me and they loved to have their tummy scratched. So I was just sort of going like that. And of course, it made wonderful pictures and the rest of it. But also the director himself was a really good speaker. And llamas and camels and lions and all of them totally uninterfered with by crowds of people preventing you from seeing them. So that was fun and I enjoyed it. And then literally last week, the government announced an enormous funding for the zoos. Now, I know lots of people worry about zoos, and to some extent, I might be one of them. But anyway, I mean, worry about whether it's a good idea or worse. But they were given 12 billion last week. 12 million, sorry, million. Oh, million. Wait a minute. How much was it? 12 million, yeah. Yeah. So that was fun. And gosh, other ones that have been fun? Well, Antarctica was great. It was a big con. It was during the Falkland War, and I told my news desk back in London that there were implications for the Antarctic Treaty, that to have a war right down there within hailing distance of the Antarctic was a thoroughly threatening event, and we ought to go and see what was going on. It was complete charade. The whole thing was totally untrue. And we flew from Chile to the Chilean base in Antarctica, which was right next to the Russian base, with whom they had no diplomatic relations at all, but happened as human beings to be totally dependent on each other. They shared a doctor, they played football together, and yet their countries didn't speak to each other. And I thought, this is the world. This is wonderful. People, in the end, have to live together, irrespective of what their governments want to do and the rest of it. I'm sure neither Moscow nor Santiago would have been pleased to know that this naughty practice was going on. But, it was wonderful. And of course, the opportunity to see the wildlife and the scenery, it's absolutely incredible. Now, of course, since then, Antarctica's got rather smaller than it was when I was there because the ice melt and the rest of it is terrifying. But there we go. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it.
Great, thank you.
Brilliant. John, you've talked quite a lot there about people coming together. And one of the interesting things I think we've all seen is that although there are more divisions than ever, globally, in some ways, we do actually feel more connected. Mm. And even in the society, you know, we've got people from around the world here. And I know Sylvain, I don't know if I'm saying your name right, but Sylvain has a question here about comparing things between countries. Are you there, Sylvain? Do you want us to come off mute and ask your question to John and tell me if I've mispronounced your name? No, he's on mute. He's doing the classic Zoom bingo. You're on mute, Sylvain.
Go along to the left-hand end.
Sorry, guys. You pronounced my name very well. I was just wondering, for a long time, the government kind of told us we can't compare between countries. Now might be a time where it's kind of becoming a bit different and where more data is available. How do you see the journalist kind of starting to do an independent review on that front?
I absolutely feel that journalists are more than happy and in fact are working hard to come together, I think, as much as possible. We depend on each other. You know, when you're on an international story, it doesn't really matter what country you come from. The fact is you're all after the same question, what's going on? And you're very dependent on each other. And I think in many ways, if our nations could reflect the way we work in the field as journalists, we'd all get on a lot better. I'm not supposed to have any views, but I'm very distressed that we're leaving the European Union. I think any coming together of countries is nothing but positive. There have to be ways that we do. And I'm certainly an internationalist, I could say that. What do you do, Sylvain? Are you a marketeer? You're in marketing?
Yes, I'm head of consumer research for Expedia. Uh-huh. But my question was more around, you know, with the COVID-19, obviously, at the beginning we kept being told, oh, you know, we're not doing that bad compared to other countries, but it just took 2 minutes to understand that you had this kind of 10 days lag because of the lockdown being different compared to continental Europe. And then as soon as the data started to come through and obviously we were catching up, that's when they stopped publishing the international data, if you remember.
I do.
And then after that, the whole story became, oh, but we can't really compare country to country because it's not the right time. So I was just thinking, now is probably a time where it starts to be, more data is becoming available for you know, the news to kind of dig.
Yeah, and I think certainly in the last 2 or 3 weeks in particular, there's been very, very strong reporting on the comparisons. And I think nobody really in Britain is unaware of the fact that we're at the bottom of the scale, that we are the worst. Well, we've got good bedfellows in Brazil and United States, if we're proud of that. I'm not conscious that I think we did know we were, the business of not locking down early enough was pretty well known within the first 4 weeks, very well known within the first 8 weeks. And now nobody, I think, could not know that we've had a very bad pandemic. Where are you, Sylvan?
Well, I'm based in London, so.
You're based in London. You've got this very exotic, lovely thing above your head.
My wife will be very proud.
Is it made of feathers?
Yeah, she makes them herself. So
beautiful. Well, I mean, you have learned something about marketing. You're hanging a very nice creation of your wife.
She actually forced me to do it when so many calls.
She's a marketing expert, no question. Very
genius.
Nice to talk to you.
Thanks.
Perfect. Oh, I have to say, this time has flown already today. We only have time for maybe one or two more questions. Toby, you've messaged me to say you'd like to ask a question of John.
Yeah, hi, John. Okay. I think one of the things that concerns me at the moment is that everything has become so binary. So if I take a good example, I mean, Churchill, now you're either allowed to hate him or love him, and you're not allowed to have any sort of in-between, even Tony Blair, a more recent example. So what's your view on that? And do you think news outlets have a role in trying to sort of move us away from that binary thing? And then, and how do news outlets show balance without just putting two extremes on and therefore saying we've landed balance because we have both ends of the spectrum?
I agree very, very strongly with you. This is a real problem. And in many ways, of course, this is part of the downside online. So much is said that is factually untrue. I remember looking at the Churchill monument with the graffiti on it. And I thought, this is much more complex than throwing paint onto somebody's statue. This is, I think we have some criticism that we didn't go into it deeply enough. I mean, once, you know, you'd have on the one side people saying this is sacrilege, and on the other side saying nothing. It was just kind of somebody daubed the statue, he was wrong or right or whatever. But we never actually explored it, and it would be very complicated to work Churchill out. I mean, he had so many lives, and fortunately he had one of them which saved us in the Second World War. I mean, and that is the life I think we would celebrate. I mean, nobody is perfect, and many of us are deeply imperfect, but some of us are imperfect and do some perfect things. And I think when you see a perfect thing in a human being, you have to celebrate it. When you see something wicked and difficult, well, you try to tackle it, but sometimes I'm glad to say that the perfection will outstrip. I mean, I think it would be quite wrong if Churchill were condemned as, a bad entity, because the answer is that without that sort of leadership, we might well never have survived the war. I mean, I know it's possible to exaggerate all that, but that's what people felt, and I think probably still feel. I mean, you and I are too young. I mean, even I am too young to have had anything to do with the war, but I've grown up thinking that, and I haven't seen much to persuade it wasn't true. I mean, sure, he was in South Africa reporting the Boer War. I've never really explored what his reports were like. I know we could read them easily because he wrote extensively, but you know, I think it's a very, very good question. Very good question.
Oh, this is a particularly fascinating subject, isn't it? The question of flawed leaders and what they bring. I think we could talk a whole other hour about that. I'm thinking a lot about Churchill at the moment. And there's lots of conversations with business leaders who are referencing his great call to action when he said, "We have no money, we should have to think." Mm. I definitely think that's going to be a challenge for businesses moving forward in the next few months. So I know
when you say that, I think, you know, we have all got to pull together, and that actually does include marketing and the people who benefit from the income you bring us as, you know, broadcasting operatives, not just the news. I mean, actors, actresses, you know, filmmakers, directors, the rest of it, you know, people feel there's something sacrilegious if we have anything much to do with how we drum up the income, but we are going to have to work together.
I think that's so important, thinking about what more we can do together, and also the way in which we've all changed our thinking about the role of the economy and business and how it helps everything run more smoothly. Oh, what a fascinating session. Thank you, Claire. Thank you, John. I'm thinking about some of us are imperfect and do perfect things as a takeaway from this session, amongst other things. Thank you, everybody, for joining. We'd like to ask you, please, there's a poll just about to arrive, because we would like to ask what you thought of today, give some feedback on how we can do things better, what you've learned from it, because we don't know what you're thinking, and we'd love to know what you're thinking.
It says host can't vote.
No, we can't say it's excellent, unfortunately.
It says we can't vote either.
Can you vote?
We don't seem to be able to vote.
I think we're all panelists now, so we can't vote.
Just make up the numbers anyway. I think 72% was the result for the first poll.
80% of statistics are made up.
That was 72%. Get that man off.
Look, you know how to contact us. Here we go. There we go. How about that? Super fast pivoting and making that happen. How did you find our webinar? Let us know. We are always interested as a society in understanding what works and what we can do better. I wish we'd had more time to take everybody's questions, but please do get in contact separately afterwards if you've got more feedback and thoughts.